This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
What happened to the Atkins diet? Hello again, I'm Norman Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Dr. Robert Atkins' book, Diet Revolution, sold 20 million copies in more than 20 languages, spawning an industry based on low-carb foods. But the craze has suddenly declined, so much that Atkins Nutritionals has declared bankruptcy. On To the Point, why has public confidence faded so fast in a regime that seemed to encourage indulgence rather than abstinence? Was the low-carb doctrine oversold or misrepresented? What fad will be next in America, where there's big money in the promise of weight reduction that's quick and easy? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the U.S. Supreme Court nominee John Roberts and gay rights. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Norman Olney, back with To the Point. The low-carb food fad is fading away so fast that Atkins Nutritional, the company that spawned it, has filed for bankruptcy. On To the Point, what happened to a diet that seemed to replace abstinence with indulgence? What'll be next? On Reporter's Notebook, the U.S. Supreme Court nominee John Roberts helped gay rights leaders win a crucial ruling. Will that help him with liberal opponents? What about Christian conservatives who have supported him so far? First, this news update. 2 weeks after the last attempted bombing, London's transit system was subject to unprecedented security today. All was quiet, at least until early this evening. Meantime, there's another threatening videotape from Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's number two man in al-Qaeda. On the tape, he mentions the London bombings and September 11th and warns there will be more to come unless the Western powers withdraw from the Middle East. From Crawford, Texas, President Bush had a response.
Zawahiri was a part of that team that attacked us on September the 11th, 2001. He was part of an al-Qaeda group that said, well, we'll try to achieve our objective in attacking America. They must not have understood the nature of our country. I vowed then that we would stay on the offense against these people. We owe it to the American people and other freedom-loving countries to bring these killers to justice. And that's what they are. They're terrorists and they're killers.
President Bush today in Crawford, Texas. Magnus Ransdorp is director of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. As always, a welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
Is there any reason to believe that this is not really Dr. al-Zawahiri?
No, I mean, I think that, of course, the CIA is doing analysis of the tape to see whether it is actually him. But I think that on the basis of past performance, all the past videos have been him. You know, it's quite unusual to actually have him in a videotape like this.
He looks a little older than he has in the past. His beard is a little grayer. There's an automatic weapon behind him on this tape. Are there any other visual cues that would lead anybody to reach conclusions they haven't been able to reach before?
No, I don't think so. I mean, they're very careful. They know very well that the intelligence agencies are analyzing exactly if they can get any clues to the background and so forth. It seems to be outdoors, and I think that the backdrop suggests with a curtain fluttering in the wind that he is outdoors. But there's nothing else to reveal his whereabouts, whether he's in Pakistan or whether he's on the borders between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Is there anything new in what he says or what he doesn't say?
Well, I mean, I think he's repeating really the fact that bin Laden offered a truce right after Madrid in 2004, the U.S. and the coalition forces had 3 months to withdraw, and it was up to the population to rise up against the Western regimes to really sort of pressure this withdrawal. I think that everyone is very nervous whenever he appears, because usually there is some type of terrorism activity in some part of the world. What is also perhaps new in the tape is the fact that he is directing a direct threat against President Musharraf of Pakistan, and also, of course, focusing in on the Palestinian issue, calling the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas to be pragmatic and that the Palestinian people should not be lured or be deceived by the Palestinian Authority. And, of course, he threatens the Egyptian regime. And also, of course, he reiterates an already heightened security fear here in Europe, and that is that he may come back to London, or he may direct attacks against London or even other countries like Italy, Denmark, or Poland who are contributors to the coalition.
Is it surprising that although he refers to the London bombings, he does not in any way claim credit for them?
Well, I think that the jury is still out whether there is any Pakistani links or to this. I think often they are quite honest in the sense of not claiming credit for things they haven't done. But certainly, it may be a call for action for those individuals that are inspired behind the revolutionary flag of al-Qaedaism that he represents. And, of course, it's also a reminder that there is a great degree of unfinished business in terms of taking out and bringing to justice the leaders that are a real U.S. security threat.
Are you surprised that President Bush would respond the way he did? Does that give Dr. al-Zahiri a kind of legitimacy, perhaps, in the eyes of his followers?
I guess that it maybe has more to do with American politics in terms of reminding the American public that there is still unfinished business. Perhaps it is lifting him up. I mean, I know that President Bush has been very careful of not mentioning Bin Laden by name and so on. But today we have different times. And, of course, the U.S. is facing great challenges in Iraq.
So overall, then, what would you conclude about the significance of this, the timing of it, and should people be especially concerned in the aftermath?
Well, I know that the intelligence agencies are very concerned whenever they see a video of this kind, because usually within a couple of weeks there is some type of action somewhere. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the United States, or it could be anywhere else. I think that it comes, of course, at a very unfortunate time when there is such a heightened security alert in London, and of course it fans the flame of those that wants to inflict mayhem and destruction.
All right. Again, Dr. Magnus Ransdorf, director of the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews. In a moment, whatever happened to the Atkins diet on To the Point?
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're now back with To the Point. Dr. Robert Atkins was a cardiologist who determined that low-fat foods with high carbohydrates led to obesity. By experimenting on himself and his patients, he found they could lose weight by cutting the carbs and getting protein from meat and other foods that are full of fat. The Atkins diet became so popular it changed the economics of the food industry. But the low-carb fad apparently has now faded away. The latest sign of that is the bankruptcy of Atkins Nutritional, one of the major companies involved. And Yalmokas McDermott is a scientist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Nutrition Research Center at Tufts University. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
There was so much promotion, not just by Dr. Atkins and his company, but others as well, about the virtues of the low-carb diet. Even fast food outlets picking it up and advertising low-carb attractions, if that's the right term. Why do you think it's declined so fast?
Well, if you look back in the history of dieting, we've actually had trends repeating over and over again. So the idea of a trend coming in, hitting hard, and then fading off isn't something new. I guess what the new aspect is the fact that so many people have banked money behind this idea this time.
What do you mean by that? There was a big investment in all of this.
It was an investment. There were companies made from this. There were books to be had and centers to run health centers to run information off of and to process patients. And then restaurants that bought into this idea, thinking that would help them market their restaurant as a whole by appealing to this particular trend. But again, It's a trend.
And on the other side of it, some companies had big trouble as a result of all of this, Krispy Kreme Donuts being one of them, blaming its decline on the popularity of the low-carb diet.
It's very interesting. So there were companies that were definitely, that benefited financially from this, and then there were companies that were negatively impacted by this kind of a trend.
What about the diet itself then? Now, you say it's they're all subject to this pattern. Are you, by saying that, are you suggesting that this one doesn't work any better than any of the others?
Well, the bottom line is when you take in fewer calories than you burn, you're going to lose weight. When you hold the number of calories that you eat balances out with what you exercise off or move off, you're going to hold weight. So any kind of a diet that's going to help you to lose to decrease the number of calories you're taking per day is going to result in weight loss. The big questions I say on diets, there actually are three questions I like to ask. Number one, does the diet help you to lose weight? Does it actually work? Number two, is it sustainable? Because we know that short-term weight loss can be had off of many, many diet forms. The question is, can you sustain that diet so that it's not just a yo-yo effect, that you're going to lose that weight that you wanted to lose and then be able to maintain that weight loss over time? Question number three, does it promote health? A jelly bean diet might help you lose weight in the short term. Is that a healthful diet ultimately for cardiovascular disease risk factors and diabetes and cancer risk and other disease processes?
One would hope that everybody would ask those three questions as they are deciding what to eat and what not to eat, but it would appear they don't necessarily do that. What do you think was so appealing about the Atkins diet?
Well, it said the thing that people wanted to hear. You don't have to count calories, that you can eat all the, quote, bad foods, because it emphasized the fact that meats and cheese and fatty foods, which are so flavorful, that you don't have to even worry about those things. And people are looking for that magic word. And if I come up with a diet that is healthful and nutritious and all, and it doesn't have the buzzwords that you like, it's much more interesting for you or easy for you to write me off and say, well, I have either Dr. McDermott's diet or I could go to Dr. Atkins' diet. And whatever sounds more appealing, we're so emotional about food. There's a lot of emotion behind food choices and what we buy into and all.
Was there a certain amount of misrepresentation about the Atkins diet? It's my understanding that Dr. Atkins advocated fruits and vegetables in addition to high-protein sources, including meat and fatty foods, but that not everybody who took the diet heard that part.
Exactly. That if you actually read the protocol for an Atkins diet, it had stages, it had phases that you went through, and the idea of going on a very restrictive carbohydrate diet was meant to be for a very short term. And then you gradually introduced other foods over time. And ultimately, it got to be a diet that was lean meats and chickens and fish and all, but it had a lot of fruits and vegetables. People didn't want to hear that part, so they found the phase that they liked, which sounded appealing, the eat all you want and the meats and the fats and cheeses and all that, and they just stuck with that part.
And Yamilkis McDermott, at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Nutrition Research Center at Tufts University. Marion Nessel is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She's author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Thank you for being with us today.
Pleasure.
In what way did the food industry, do you think, which you have studied so closely, contribute to A, the Atkins diet and its widespread popularity, and B, misrepresentations about it?
Well, the food industry's job is to sell food, and that's what they're in the business of doing. And their idea, you know, the idea of any food company that's involved in selling food is to sell more and to get people to eat as much as possible, not to eat less. So that as soon as it became clear that this particular version of the Atkins diet was going to be extremely popular, popularized by articles in the New York Times and so forth, the company started making products to cash in on what was obviously an enormous craze. And so companies started making low-carb products or supposedly low-carb products, and that's when you started seeing low-carb bread and low-carb pasta and other kinds of oxymorons that made no sense at all. And some of these were advertised with rather misleading health claims on them or with misleading statements about what these foods were going to do. So they gave the impression that if you ate a low-carb diet, you'd be eating fewer calories. And if you ate fewer calories, calories, you'd be losing weight.
I take it you say that's a misrepresentation. Can you give us some examples of...
Oh, net carbs. The food companies invented the term net carbs, which were carbohydrates that were the ones that counted in foods. I mean, I remember buying some low-carb pasta, which I thought was just hilarious. It had 42 grams of carbohydrate per serving, and only five of those were net, and so those were the five that were supposed to count. And then you said, well, what happened to the other 37? Well, they weren't counting those because those were absorbed less rapidly, but they still had calories.
What about the low-carb Oreo cookies put out by Kraft?
Oh, I love the low-carb Oreo cookies. Now, Kraft was a little bit late getting in on this, and their low-carb cookies only came out this year, well after the peak of the low-carb dieting. And what I particularly like about them is that they got the serving size of the low-carb cookies down to 100 calories per serving instead of the 160 calories per serving that you get in a usual serving of Oreo cookies, regular ones. And they were able to do this quite cleverly. They just changed the serving size from 3 to 2 cookies. So the usual serving size is 3 cookies, 160 calories. They just changed it to two cookies at 100 calories. So that works.
That suggests that people are, in fact, susceptible to a kind of manipulation in the interest of, as you said, selling food and getting people to eat as much of it as possible. What about the government? What about labeling? What about the responsibility of the food industry for people's nutrition?
Well, the Food and Drug Administration really doesn't have its Carbohydrate Act together. It was never a problem before, and so they were really quite unprepared for dealing with the low-carbohydrate dieting problem. There's been a lot of pressure on the FDA to do something about sugar labeling, but they've resisted that because it's difficult to tell the difference between added sugars and sugars that are naturally in foods, and there's an enormous pressure from the food industry not to have separate labeling for added sugars. So they're subject to political pressures just like any other government agency, and in particular the FDA is under tremendous pressure from Congress not to regulate food industries too heavily right now.
Why is that?
It's the kind of political era that we're in right now. This is a very anti-regulatory and very business-friendly government, and anything that puts restrictions on food businesses is not something that's very popular with this particular administration.
Marion Nessel at New York University, author of Food Politics. Back to Anne Yelmolkas McDermott. You're with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Nutrition Research Center at Tufts University. Does being associated with the government under these political circumstances put you in a difficult position?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Not at all. I'm a Tufts University employee. But even in our center, I think our emphasis is on the fact of getting down to the basics of what counts, energy in and energy out. If you look at the new CDC website, mypyramid.gov, they have taken the most recent science and come up with guidelines that will help people. And people refer to this as a new pyramid. And in that new pyramid is an emphasis on fruits and vegetables. There's 8 to 10 servings a day. There's an emphasis on dietary variety, in particular within food groups. The idea of moderation and balance is for the first time emphasized in our pyramid. And activity plays a major role. We know that we're a very sedentary nation, and we need to find ways to increase our physical activity every day. And dietary quality. And I don't think there's a scientist out there that's going to argue with those concepts.
So, Marion Nessel, back to you. There's a lot of information available, more and more sophisticated, based on what science is telling us about nutrition. How good a job is the food industry in particular, and the government as well, doing in getting that information out?
Well, the food industry is where most people get their nutrition information. Food companies and beverage companies spend about $36 billion a year in promoting individual products. And that number is so large, it's just incomprehensible to me. But McDonald's alone spends more than $1 billion a year just in the United States, just on media advertising. And a single product like Cheez-Its or Lunchables has a $25 million a year advertising budget just for media, not even all the other things that they're doing. No government agency has anywhere near that kind of money to put into nutrition advising for the public. So the public is enormously confused because they're hearing messages about individual products, and there is no really unified voice coming out of the government telling people what it is that they're supposed to be eating. The new Department of Agriculture pyramid, you have to have a computer to use it. If you don't have a computer, you don't have access to that pyramid. And so that cuts out not only a large segment of the population, but it cuts out the segment of the population that probably needs that advice the most. There has never been an advertising budget coming out of the federal government to tell people in a unified and comprehensive way about diet and activity patterns with anywhere near the kind of money that even the tiniest single food product has on a yearly basis.
Marion Nestle at New York University, again, author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Bob Golden is Executive Vice President at Technomic, which is a Chicago-based food industry consulting firm. Mr. Golden, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
Are the companies deceiving people and misleading them in the advertising that they put out in order, as Marion Nestle put it earlier, to sell more food?
In a word, no. I don't believe there's any deliberate intent to do so. It's not in the best interests of companies to do that. At the same point in time, as Dr. Nestle pointed out, they are in the business of selling products in the most appropriate and creative fashion that they possibly can.
On the other hand, when Oreo cookies just reduces the serving size and says thereby you're reducing your carbs, that's a little bit on one side of the line, isn't it?
Well, again, I think they do provide information on their packages. I think that the whole food labeling is of great confusion to the typical consumer, and serving sizes in calorie count relative to serving sizes is one area of tremendous confusion. But in defense of Kraft, I think they are disclosing that, and there's a little bit of a caveat emptor in some of that situation.
Is there any effort on the food industry's part to get together and speak with one voice, or is it so competitive that that's just out of the question?
Well, I think it's highly competitive. The industry, as Dr. Nestle pointed out, has absolutely no desire to see government regulation or any form of regulation. So they are the best is to self-regulate. There's no real consistent voice because different companies have different perspectives on the seriousness and the appropriate response to health and nutrition.
So they all have their own nutritionists and they all disagree.
Well, I don't know if disagree, but they present the facts and issues differently relative to their view of the world and their portfolio.
All right, we're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, Bob Golden, I'd like to ask you this question. What's going to happen to the companies that have invested so much, as we heard earlier from Anne Yelmokas de McDermott, in the idea of low-carb foods? If that isn't the trend anymore, what's going to be next? We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about America's apparently unending appetite, if that's the right word, for quick-fix diets. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, the U.S. Supreme Court, the nominee John Roberts, and gay rights. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the extraordinary rise and precipitous collapse of the low-carb food fad popularized by the Atkins diet. Once again, Atkins Nutritional filing for bankruptcy protection just this week. Bob Golden is Executive Vice President at Technomic, a Chicago-based food industry consulting firm. And, Mr. Golden, it appears that a year and a half ago, something like 10% of Americans were on the low-carb diet. That's a lot of people. But that has dropped down to in the neighborhood of 2% or less right now. What about all of these companies that have invested in the low-carb diet and tried to promote it as vigorously as they have? What happens to them now?
Well, many of the companies that jumped on the bandwagon in a real mass market way were very large food companies, Unilever and Kraft as examples, who came out with controlled carb products and are well able to absorb what in essence is a new product failure, but a costly one at that. And, you know, I think there's some lessons to be learned in terms of reading the tea leaves.
What about other companies? What about the people that grow potatoes and deal in pasta and Krispy Kreme donuts and all those others that had such a problem during the low-carb fad?
You know, I am one who doesn't necessarily give full credence to the fact that, that the number of low-carb dieters was anything ever close to what was reported. And I think that the impact has been kind of minimal and short-lived. And for a number of companies, and I will use Krispy Kreme, I think looked at the quote-unquote low-carb trend, which, again, I don't believe ever really was a trend. It was a blip or a fad, is a convenient excuse to explain away other business problems.
Ah, that's an interesting point. Let me go back to Marion Nestle at the Department of Nutrition at New York University. What about the media in all of this? As you indicated, and I believe Anne McDermott indicated as well, there was an enormous amount of publicity about this, the New York Times and all other kinds of media. Was the fad, so-called, merely a blip?
Well, I think it's a blip, and there'll be plenty more blips. But one of the things that made it so important in the media was that there were so many reporters who were on the diet and were losing weight like mad. So many of them wrote stories about their tremendous success in losing weight. And then they don't talk so much now about whether they've gained it back or not. Most of them have. But the one of the things about the Atkins diet that made it really popular was that it worked at the beginning and was very, very successful in getting a lot of weight off very quickly and encouraging people to think that this was going to work tremendously well for them.
So we're back to Anne McDermott's three questions. One, does it help lose weight? I take it the answer to that is yes. Two, is it sustainable? Apparently not, if the reporters are any indication. And three, does it promote good health? Marion Nestle, does it promote good health?
Oh, no. I mean, everybody knows you're not supposed to eat huge amounts of fat and saturated fat in the diet, and you need a diet that has lots and lots of fruits and vegetables. And people interpreted the Atkins diet as being one that was mostly meat and dairy-based, particularly high-fat meat and dairy, and that they weren't supposed to eat vegetables. I mean, I sat next to people at dinner parties who wouldn't eat the carrots on their plate because carrots have a little sugar in them. I mean, I just thought it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen.
So there was a lot of misinformation, misunderstanding, and people presumably then, as you indicated earlier, chose the particular phase of the diet they liked the best and then apparently didn't get the kind of results they wanted ultimately.
Well, they did get the results they wanted at the beginning and absolutely swore by it. And I knew all kinds of food writers and food reporters who were on it and were just doing splendidly on it, at least for a while.
Let me go back to the point made at the outset by Ann Yalmokas McDermott that there is a repetitive trend in the United States of a diet fadding. We'll get back and hear more from Bob Golden about that as well. But I want to introduce Andrew Buncombe, who's looking at all of this from the standpoint of his job as Washington correspondent for The Independent, which, of course, is a newspaper based in the United Kingdom. Andrew Buncombe, welcome to you.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What conclusions have you drawn about what appears to be the rise and fall of the low-carb diet?
Well, I'm more than happy to let the real experts speak on this, and I think they make a lot of sense. I'm more than happy to believe it's nothing more than a fad. I'm currently taking up Anne's jelly bean diet because it sounds so good. I think that'll work.
Well,
for
it'll
me.
Work for a while.
But what strikes me in the 4 years that I've been living in the U.S. It's just the world of extremes in which we all live in here. I mean, when I sit down and watch TV, I'm always amazed by the television adverts that pop up. From 1 minute, it'll be someone trying to sell me a gym machine, usually Chuck Norris or someone else with his shirt off, selling the perfect body. The next, it's some vast meal called Hungry Man or something, which belittles people who eat quiche and makes gluttony something to be admired. Nowhere amongst any of this is any common sense. I mean, I think most people know that, you know, if you eat a mixed diet, if you look to diets that have historically worked, the Mediterranean diet, for example, fruit and veg and carbohydrates and some proteins, I think people know all this works. So introducing these new kind of stunty ideas just seems to me part of extremism. You know, but something is clearly out of control. We all know about the obesity in this country, and I should say rapidly on the growth in the UK. The UK is not so far behind, so something clearly needs to be done. I'm very interested in the way in which we just eat so much rubbish, and that we don't even know it. We were talking earlier about the food labeling, but I'm always amazed, for example, when I'm buying my orange juice or whatever, your fruit drink or whatever, and I see corn syrup in there. And what on earth am I doing eating corn syrup? What role does that have in a product? So I'd say two things. One is, I think, you know, let's try and reintroduce common sense. Let's try and get away from this extreme. Let's try and get away from the perfect six-pack abs. And at the same time, let's get away from these 64-ounce burgers. But also, let's be a bit more transparent about the labels and the names we give things.
I want to ask you about America as a World of Extremes. The Atkins Diet book was translated into 20 languages and sold millions of copies around the world. Is it just Americans that are stuck with this?
Well, dare I say, what America does first, you know, the rest of the world also follows. No, I think the wonderful thing, the wonderful niche selling point of the Atkins diet was that it was the lazy man's diet. It meant you didn't have to give up too much. But it also was a very American, wasn't it? It was the diet of indulgence. It meant you could keep the steak. It meant you could keep the burger. It meant you could have the double fried chicken, Philly steak, whatever. These are all icons of American cuisine, I guess. And I think, you know, people were attracted by this idea.
Andrew Buncombe with The Independent, based in the United Kingdom. Back to Bob Golden with Technomic, the industry consulting firm. What about that aspect of the Atkins diet, perhaps misunderstanding it, but nonetheless emphasizing the indulgence aspect of it, as Marianne Nessel pointed out, and as you agreed, the food industry wants to sell more food, not less. So was this an opportunity then for the food industry that caused many companies, as you put it, to jump on the bandwagon?
No, I think this one, I think the Atkins diet came on with such force so quickly it actually caught almost every food company off guard. It also ended that quickly, but nonetheless, I think it's something that came on due a lot to, I think, a media mania about it, which was somewhat unjustified by participation levels or results, but somehow, and perhaps it was Mary Nessel suggested, a lot of reporters were on the diet and they started writing about it, but there was just this, and Dr. Atkins was a very, very good and visible promoter. So I think the media really jumped on these stories, as they tend to do in the food industry. What's going on in food intake and consumption in general got a tremendous amount of publicity. And as I say, it really came on extremely quickly, caught almost all these food companies off guard, and they responded in not necessarily the most strategic, intelligent fashion.
Andrew Buncombe, back to you. Did you know reporters in the Washington Press Corps or elsewhere who were on the Atkins diet and trying to promote it themselves?
Oh, I'm going to have to sort of let you down there. I'm afraid I don't. I mean, I kind of knew people secondhand who were doing it, saying they were doing it. No close colleagues in Washington. I knew some people in London who did it and swore by it. They said, I was talking to one the other day, and she said it was very successful. But Dr. McDermott says this. Oh, sorry, Dr. McDermott pointed out the friend of mine was following it pretty much as the book had said it, and it wasn't really doing what most people would know by the Atkins diet. I think there is a lot about this media thing. I think it was a huge story. I think it was an easy story. You know, and I think perhaps, ironically enough, one of the reasons for the diet's success was two pieces of bad report. Reasons not only for the diet's success, but also for its demise, were two pieces of bad reporting. There was initial bad reporting that sort of misdescribed the diet and described it purely as a sort of eat all the meat you can diet, and obviously that got people attracted. Then secondly, I think the company was struck very badly by the circumstances of Dr. Atkins' death. A lot of misreporting surrounding that, when people conflated a heart attack he had in 2002 with his death in 2003, when he actually fell and hit his head and was in a coma. Of course, you know, people said he died. A lot of people believed, became an urban myth, that he died of a heart attack brought on by eating too much meat. So, yeah, of course, the media has a role, but you know, the media doesn't invent these things. I think often we seize on these stories and because they're easy and they're entertaining or what have you. But no, the fuel for this story isn't the media. I think it's society's aims and needs and wishes and what have you, and also there's, you know, the entire advertising industry that goes hand in hand with the food industry.
Andrew Buncombe with the Independent, Washington correspondent, a paper, of course, based in the UK. Back to our first guest, Daniel Mulcahy McDermott at the Nutrition Research Center at Tufts University. One thing we haven't talked about much on this program is exercise, although Andrew Buncombe did mention the gym machines that are often promoted with the guy with the perfect body and the abs and so on. Why is it, do you think, that hasn't become more of a fad than it has? It certainly has in some places. In Los Angeles, you see people jogging, and I'm sure that's true in other places as well. But it's certainly an important factor in all of this. Why doesn't it get more promotion and more attention, do you think? Is it hard?
It's hard because someone actually has to change their behavior. There's no magic pill here. There's no magic recipe. And it's pretty straightforward. About 100 calories are going to be burned about every time you do 1 mile. And then people say, oh, my gosh, you mean 100 calories, that's it, for a mile? And they don't stop and think about all the other changes that occur in the body, what that means. If I exercise, if I do that 1 mile, I now have more muscle mass. If I have more muscle mass, I have a higher metabolic rate. 24 hours a day, I have a higher metabolic rate, and that's going to help me get towards my end output of losing body fat. So there's an action, a decision the patient has to make, the person has to make, and then they have to actually take responsibility for that day in and day out. That's a scary thing for people, and it's so much easier. As long as we have conflict in the media, as long as we have people arguing with each other as to the magic way to get to the end point, the inclination is for many to go towards the easier end point.
Well, is there anything really surprising about that from a psychological standpoint?
Not on my end, there isn't. I don't know. Maybe someone else might say so. But it's human nature. And it's one thing I'm really hoping for in the future, that the next trend we see in the dietary end is that idea that diet includes energy in and energy out. It is not one side of the equation. That we have to talk both about the food that we're eating and about how much we're moving in a day. The other aspect is there's a lot of emphasis on this in the CDC, in the MyPyramid.gov and the new pyramid with activity, and the idea of 30, 60, or 90 minutes a day of activity, depending upon your goal. People confuse the terminology physical activity and exercise, and so physical activity is any movement. It can be you're carrying your groceries. It can be you're going up and down the stairs in your home. It can be walking from the parking across the parking lot from your car to the mall. Exercise is a dedicated, repetitive action like going for a jog or a walk. They all add up. They all count. Your body doesn't know which one it's doing. It just knows that it needs to expend calories in order to take in more calories and not gain weight.
Andrew Buncombe with The Independent, as a student over the past 4 years of the American media, do you think that's going to become a story because of what's happened with the Atkins diet?
I'm so sorry. In what sense?
Will we suddenly be talking about energy in and energy out? And don't forget, that's the only way to look at this. And you've got to do more exercise, even though requires changes in behavior. Do you think that makes a better story than there's an easy way to lose weight?
It sounds a little bit serious to me. I think it sounds a little bit. And it's not sexy, as we say in the business, is it? You know, hard work will get results. Common sense will get results. No, I don't think there's a, I don't think there's much future for that story, I'm afraid.
Marion Nestle, author of Food Politics, is there any way to predict what the next trend, the next blip, or a fad, whatever it turns out to be, is going to be?
Well, I'm hoping it's going to be portion size, and that people will now start focusing on the amount of calories that you get from larger portions. But I think that nobody can predict the future, but I can guarantee you without question that there will be more fad diets.
Okay, well, that's where we're going to leave it. And thank you all very much for being with us. Marion Nestle at New York University, author of Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Thanks to Ann Ilmokas-McDermott at the USDA Nutrition Research Center at Tufts, Bob Golden with Technomic, the Chicago-based food industry consulting firm, and Andrew Buncombe, the Washington correspondent for the British paper The Independent. Today's Los Angeles Times reports that Supreme Court nominee John Roberts helped gay activists win what they call the single most important positive ruling in the history of the gay rights movement. Will that help him with liberal opponents? What about Christian conservatives who have been his supporters? More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In 1996, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a Colorado initiative discriminated on the basis of sexual orientation. In dissent, Justice Antonin Scalia said, "Coloradans are entitled to be hostile toward homosexual conduct." John Roberts' appointment to the court has been opposed by liberals who claim he's too much like Justice Scalia. But lawyers on the winning side of that case say that Roberts' advice as counsel was absolutely crucial to their success. He participated on a pro bono basis for his Washington law firm. Elliot Mintzberg is vice president and legal director for the People for the American Way, which is a civil rights group, progressive group, lobbying against his appointment to the Supreme Court. Mr. Mintzberg, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Does his involvement in this case, which is called absolutely crucial by the Lambda Defense Fund, the gay and lesbian legal organization, change your mind in any way about Mr. Roberts?
Well, we haven't formally opposed the nomination at this point, but we continue to have serious doubts that this unfortunately doesn't do much about. I was also at Hogan & Hartson at one point in my career, and the firm often asks its appellate lawyers like John Roberts to help other people in the firm to do a moot court, do advice to clients and others that are participating in an important case in the court. It's certainly praiseworthy that John Roberts did that, but to us what's more important is the growing evidence in the record of what he did during the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations that really cut back civil rights and privacy protections in a number of different fronts.
Well, does this suggest that he was a good lawyer in both cases representing what his clients wanted him to do?
Well, in some ways, yes, in some ways, no, because there's no question that the positions that he took in the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations were political positions, high-level positions in several cases, where he made the affirmative decision to sign up with folks that had an agenda, unfortunately, to cut back civil rights and constitutional protections in a number of areas. It's not as if he was a career Justice Department attorney who just handled the cases that happened to come down. To his credit, I think that this was a case where he could have said no to his colleague. He wasn't required to do it, but as a good colleague in the firm, he agreed to help out another lawyer in the firm who wanted to help out these advocates.
This was a pretty important case to the gay rights movement, according to the lawyers who were involved with it as well. So in that sense, why doesn't that, I guess I should say, in any way, as far as you're concerned, counteract his earlier actions?
I don't think it's a question of counteracting. I think what has to be done for any nominee is look at their entire record. And the record that is beginning to emerge more and more is a record, unfortunately, of a committed conservative activist during the Reagan and Bush administrations. Lambda Legal Defense Fund itself, the group that you talked about, has issued a statement saying that while certainly what he did in that case was appreciated, they're more concerned about some of the positions that he took and actions that he took that tried to set the law in the other direction in very significant ways. And I think all we're saying is that that should be the prime basis on which his nomination is judged.
Elliot Mintzberg with the People for the American Way, a group that I misrepresented earlier by saying they decided to oppose Mr. Roberts. I gather you haven't done that as yet, but you're raising concerns about his nomination. Phyllis Schlafly is president of the Eagle Forum. That's a conservative pro-family group. She's author of The Supremacists, The Tyranny of Judges, and How to Stop It. Ms. Schlafly, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, first of all, are you in favor of Mr. Roberts' appointment? Secondly, in either case, does his role in this particular case make any difference to you?
Oh, yes, I'm cautiously optimistic about Judge Roberts, but I'm so disappointed. I was hoping that this new news might persuade Elliot to endorse Roberts. It certainly was a decision that was very important to the gay rights movement. I think it does show that he's not a Scalia. We were hoping that President Bush, as he said or led us to believe, that he would appoint judges like Scalia or Thomas. And I guess he's not a Scalia, but we hope he's a Rehnquist.
Well, Rehnquist also opposed this particular decision by the court, as did Justice Thomas. And again, you and others have said those are the people that Mr. Roberts should be most like. Why doesn't it shake your support for him that he was involved in such an important way in this particular case?
We don't know. Was he assigned by his firm to do this? You say he could have rejected it, but unfortunately, the left wingers in this country have been much more effective in getting pro bono work from prestigious law firms than conservative causes, and they're very aggressive about getting that pro bono work. And I guess they got him to join it. So I think, as Elliot says, you have to look at the whole record.
What about the Christian conservative movement? Do you think that they're going to have problems with that? We called a few of the groups involved, the Focus on the Family and others. They indicated that they were concerned. They hadn't taken any position as yet studying the case. As you might expect, this hasn't been abroad for very long. But do you think that they're going to perhaps change their minds about Mr. Roberts as a result?
Oh, I doubt it. I cast a little cloud, but on balance, as I say, we didn't get a Scalia or Thomas, but we're hopeful that he certainly is going to be a big improvement over Justice O'Connor, who voted repeatedly for abortion, repeatedly for gay rights, and repeatedly against the Ten Commandments. So almost anything would be an improvement.
Okay, Phyllis Schlafly with the Eagle Forum. Back to Elliot Mintzberg with People for the American Way. Is it true in your experience that left-wingers, as she put it, have been better at getting pro bono assistance from big firms like the one that you and Mr. Roberts were both in?
Well, I think that might have been true once upon a time. I think that the right has done a much better job recently at least equalizing that. It's interesting with respect to Judge Roberts, when he did that work in that particular case and in several others that I was involved with, one of the reasons that Roberts was such a popular choice to be on those moot courts is because he, it was thought, would be a good person to essentially play a Rehnquist-Scalia-type judge in those moot courts. So we don't know what's going to happen, but maybe Phyllis will get her wish after all.
Apparently that was part of the role that he did play in this instance, according to the other attorneys who were involved in this. Ms. Schlafly, Roberts taking the role of, reading now from the Los Angeles Times, the role of a Scalia-like justice to pepper the attorneys with the tough questions, and apparently he got it right. They were exactly the kinds of questions that Justice Scalia did ask when they finally got into court. Again, does that give you pause?
Again, I have to look at the whole record. I didn't jump up and down when he was appointed, but we're hopeful that he will be a good justice. I suppose you'll never get anybody who's absolutely perfect unless he's a clone of Clarence Thomas.
You're both vote counters, no question. Ms. Schlafly, first to you. What do you think of the prospects at the moment of Justice Roberts, and to what extent do you think this might hurt him in the Senate?
People will make some speeches and give some interviews about it, but I am rather confident he will be confirmed.
And by how big a vote do you think?
I think by a pretty good size vote. He really is a very attractive judge, and he seems to be respected by people on all sides. And if he doesn't decide everything our way, well, I suppose that's the way the ball bounces. But we expect him to be confirmed by a large vote.
Elliot Mintzberg, what's your sense about the possibility of confirmation?
I think it's very early to tell. Again, so much of his record was a blank slate, and now more and more of it is being filled in. So far, the Bush administration has either refused to produce documents on his record in the Bush 1 administration or slow-walked about 50,000 remaining documents in the Reagan administration. And already we're hearing people beginning to express a good deal of concern about his role in the Reagan-Bush efforts against civil rights. So I think, given that senators are away on vacation now, have been really ever since these documents began to be uncovered, that it is too early to tell. He's made a very good impression, no question about that, on the senators that he's visited with, but more than a majority have made clear that they're holding judgment, waiting for the hearings, waiting to see what comes out, and I think that's going to be the time that we'll both be able to figure out with a little more certainty what's likely to happen.
Important question with just a couple of seconds left, unfortunately, but what do you think, Elliot Mintzberg, is more important, a nominee's views or the actions he's taken?
I think it's a combination of both, and the two often reflect each other. With many of the things during the Reagan-Bush administration, it was both the views that he had and the actions he took to implement them that attempted to set back civil rights progress in a number of areas.
Ms. Schlafly, what would you say to that question?
Well, I think both are important, but Roberts is not going to set back civil rights. He believes in a proper role of the judiciary, and I think the liberals just want to give him a hard time, but they're going to end up confirming him.
Phyllis Schlafly of the Eagle Forum, author of The Supremacists, The Tyranny of Judges and How to Stop It. Thank you. Thanks to Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way. Good to have you both on our program.
Pleasure to be
here. Thank
you.
Today's program produced by Jonah King with Cherise Williams and Francis Anderton, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.